Greenstreet wrote, "The monotony of life here is getting on our nerves. Nothing to do, nowhere to walk, no change in surroundings, food or anything. God send us open water soon, or we shall go balmy." Then, on January the 13th, a rumour spread that Shackleton was considering killing the dogs to ease the drain on the food supplies. Among the men, reactions ranged from simple resignation to outraged shock. Stormy debates on the value of the dogs against the food they consumed broke out in each tent that night. But the fundamental underlying factor in these discussions was that for many men, the dogs were more than so many pounds of pulling power on the trail. There was a deep emotional attachment involved. It was the basic human need to love something, the desire to express tenderness in this barren place. Though the dogs were vicious, surly beasts with one another, their devotion and loyalty toward the men was above question. And the men responded with an affection greatly surpassing anything they would have felt under ordinary circumstances. At the thought of losing Gruss, a puppy born a year before on the Endurance, Macklin reflected, "He's a fine little dog, hard-working and of good disposition. Also I've had him, fed him and trained him since he was born. I remember taking him out when he was a puppy in my pocket, only his nose peeping out and getting covered with frost. I used to take him on the sledge when I was driving the team, and in those early days he used to take an active interest in the doings of the dogs." Under the best circumstances, it would have been upsetting news. Under their present circumstances, it was amplified in the minds of some men almost to a catastrophe. In their bitterness, a few, like Greenstreet, were inclined to fix the blame on Shackleton, with some justification. "The present shortage of food," Greenstreet wrote, "is due simply and solely from the boss refusing to get seals when they were to be had, and even refusing to let Ord Lees to go out to look for them. His sublime optimism all the way through being, to my mind, absolute foolishness. Everything right away through was going to turn out all right, and no notice was taken of things possibly turning out otherwise. And here we are." Shackleton made no mention of killing the dogs the next morning. Instead, he ordered the men to shift camp because their flow was melting at a dangerous rate. The soot from the blubber stove had been tracked all over the surface of the ice, and it was holding the heat of the sun. The men began at noon to construct a roadway of blocks of ice and snow to bridge the gap to a flow about 150 yards to the southeast. The move was completed early in the afternoon. They named their new location Patience Camp. Then, in a quiet, level voice, Shackleton ordered Wild to shoot his own team, along with McElroy's, Marston's, and Crean's. There was no protest, no argument. The four drivers obediently harnessed their teams and drove the dogs about a quarter of a mile away from the camp. The drivers then returned alone, except for McElroy. He and Macklin were to assist Wild. Each dog in turn was taken off his trace and led behind a row of large ice hummocks. There, Wild sat the animal in the snow, took the muzzle in his left hand, and placed his revolver close to its head. Death was instantaneous. After each dog had been killed, Macklin and McElroy dragged its body a short distance away, then returned to the waiting teams for the next animal. None of the dogs seemed to sense what was happening, and each went unsuspectingly around the ice hummock to his death, with his tail wagging. When the job was done, the three men piled snow on top of the heap of dog bodies and walked slowly back to camp. Shackleton decided to spare Greenstreet's team of year-old puppies for the present, and he also granted a one-day reprieve to Hurley's and Macklin's teams, so they might be used to make a trip back to Ocean Camp for some of the food that had been left there. The two sledges were made ready, and Hurley and Macklin started off at 6:30 that evening. It was an exhausting journey, lasting almost 10 hours, because they had to travel mostly over deep, soft snow and broken ice, and the dogs sank down to their bellies. As Macklin wrote later, "The going was so bad that they could not pull my weight, and I had to get off and flounder along beside the sledges. The dogs, too, kept falling back, and as soon as one dog collapsed or let his weight come onto the trace, the whole line stopped. On these occasions, They all lay down, and only violent abuse and vigorous treatment had any effect in raising them. Several pressure ridges had to be broken with pick and shovel. Finally, with all the dogs dead beat, we crawled into Ocean Camp about 4 a.m. They found the place almost underwater. To get into the galley where the stores were, they had to lay down a bridge of planks. However, they managed to collect 2 loads of about 500 pounds apiece, consisting of canned vegetables, tapioca, dog pemmican, and jam. They prepared themselves a good meal of canned stew, fed the dogs, and started back at 6:30 a.m. The return journey was comparatively easy, because they had their own tracks to follow. The dogs pulled magnificently, though old Bosun, Macklin's leader, was so exhausted he repeatedly vomited and staggered badly. The 2 sledges reached Patience Camp at 1 in the afternoon, and the dogs dropped in the snow, Macklin recorded, some of them not even rousing themselves to take their food. Lying in his sleeping bag that night, Macklin wearily recorded the events of the journey in his diary. In a tired hand, he concluded the entry. My dogs will be shot tomorrow. Chapter 2 2 tents away, old Chippy McNeish was also writing his diary. It had been a discouraging day of muggy, dead calm weather, and the carpenter was tired. Since early morning he'd been busy coating the seams of the boats with seal blood to keep the caulking in once they were in the water. No wind of any kind, he wrote. We're still in hope of a southwest breeze that'll leave us before the winter sets in. The next morning, 3 seals were sighted, and Macklin was sent out with Tom Crean to fetch them. When they returned, Shackleton told Macklin that since the party now had a fair supply of meat, his dogs would not be killed quite yet. Hurley's team, though, including the leader Shakespeare, the biggest of all the dogs, was shot. Wild, as usual, was executioner, and he took the dogs over to a distant floe to kill them. Macklin later found one of the dogs still alive, and immediately took out his knife and stabbed the animal to death. About 3 p.m., the wind gently eased around to the southwest, and a chill came into the air. Throughout the night, the temperature crept downward, and all the next day, the southwest breeze held steady. That night, Shackleton wrote almost timorously, "This may be the turn in our fortune." By now, the wind was not taken lightly. "It is spoken of with reverence," Hurley observed, "and wood must be touched when commenting thereon." Somebody, it appeared, had touched the proper piece of wood. The wind came on the next day, a whole gale out of the southwest, with driving snow filling the air and the tents quaking with its violence. They huddled in their sleeping bags, dismally uncomfortable, but radiantly happy. 50 miles an hour, McNeish recorded blissfully, "but as welcome and as much more as long as the tents stand." It howled on into January the 19th, unabated. Shackleton, the man of unbridled optimism, confined himself to guarded phrases lest he somehow hex this glorious wind. "We ought to be making north some now," he said with the utmost restraint. On the 20th, as the gale continued, a very few of them began to tire of the wet from the wind-driven snow filtering into the tents. "We're never satisfied," Hurley wrote, "as we are looking forward to a fine day. Our gear in the tents is becoming very wet, and the opportunity of drying same will be hailed." But most of them cheerfully endured the dreadful conditions, happy in the knowledge that they must be making good progress to the north. "One hardly likes to guess what our distance may be," Shackleton wrote more boldly. "But tonight is the 4th of this blow, and there are no signs of it abating, so we ought to have made a good distance to the north. Lees and Worsley are the only pessimistic ones in the camp, but this strong wind even made Lees suggest larger stakes on the strength of our distance." The next day the gale roared on, with a few gusts to 70 miles an hour. But twice during the morning the sun broke through the clouds. Worsley was ready with his sextant, and James stood by with his theodolite to catch the angle of the sun. They took their sights, worked out the calculations, and announced the result. "Wonderful!" Amazing, splendid, Shackleton wrote. Latitude 65 degrees 43 minutes south, 73 miles north drift. The most cheerful good fortune for a year for us. We cannot be much more than 170 miles from Paulet. Everyone greeted the news with cheers. The wind still continues. We may get another 10 miles out of it. Thank God. Drifting still all wet in the tents, but no matter. Had Bannock to celebrate north of the circle. The Antarctic Circle now lay nearly a full degree of latitude behind them. The gale eased down the following day, and the sun shone brightly. All hands emerged from their tents, glad to be alive. They took oars from the boats and drove them into the ice, rigged lines between them, and hung up sleeping bags, blankets, boots, and floor cloths. One would have thought it was our washing day, McNeish reported cheerfully. Later in the day, Worsley got another sight, which put their position at 65 degrees, 32 and a half minutes south, 52 degrees, 4 minutes west, 11 miles north in 24 hours. It brought the total run since the beginning of the gale to 84 miles in 6 days. Furthermore, the drift to the east away from land amounted to only a paltry 15 miles. By evening, the gale had blown itself out, and the wind shifted to the north. But nobody minded. A northerly wind was just what they needed to open up the pack so that they could take to the boats. The wind continued into the next day without loosening the pack perceptibly. They waited. The following day, Worsley climbed to the top of a 60-foot berg a short distance to the southeast. He returned with the news that the floe on which Ocean Camp had stood had apparently been blown closer during the gale and was now only about 5 miles away. Through the glasses, he had seen the old wheelhouse storeroom and the third boat, the Stancomb Wills. What about open water? Worsley shook his head. None, he said, except a small patch far to the south. Still, the opening would come. It was bound to. A heavy mist rolled in on January the 25th, and to McNeish, it was a proper sea fog, indicating the presence of the ice-free ocean nearby. Shackleton, too, thought it must be a sea fog. But the opening still did not come, and the boss felt his patience growing thin. On the 26th, after a day of unrelieved monotony, he took his diary and wrote across the space provided for that day, "Waiting, waiting, waiting." But by the time a week had passed, most of the men were abandoning their hopes. They could see almost no change in the pack. If anything, it was tighter than before, packed together by the force of the winds, perhaps driven against some unknown land to the north or northwest. The sense of immediacy gradually diminished, and the atmosphere in the camp settled once more into reluctant resignation. Fortunately, the men were kept fairly well occupied. At their new position, game was abundant, and all hands were busy hunting seals and sledging them into camp. By January the 30th, 8 days after the gale ended, they had laid in a stock of 11 seals. Shackleton decided to send Macklin's and Greenstreet's teams on another trip to Ocean Camp. Since Greenstreet, who had been suffering an attack of rheumatism for about 2 weeks, could not make the trip, his team was assigned to Crean. The two men were instructed to bring back anything of value they could find. This time, sledging conditions were considerably better, and the trip took less than 10 hours. The teams returned with some odds and ends of stores, including a quantity of canned herring, 60 pounds of bullion cubes, and a large amount of tobacco. They also obtained a good number of books, among them several volumes of the Encyclopaedia Britannica, which were especially welcome. Even McNeish, a devout Presbyterian, allowed as how he would enjoy a change from his Bible, which he had repeatedly reread from cover to cover. For the next 2 days, Shackleton carefully observed the movements of the pack, and then he decided that a party of 18 under Wild should start out early the next morning to bring up the Stancomb Wills. The news came as a great relief. For some time, many of the men, particularly the seamen, had had strong misgivings about the advisability of trying to crowd the entire party into 2 boats. "I'm very glad," Worsley wrote. "If it comes to boats, we shall be far safer in 3. With only two, it would be a practical impossibility to bring 28 men alive through a boat voyage of any length. The sledging party was awakened at 1 a.m. the next morning.